problems are systemic. It's, sure. It's rarely, it maybe one person is kind of, we see it in one person at the time, but usually we all of a sudden we see it happening all around. And now leaders have to work across disciplines to communicate with each other, understand what's happening in the culture. And then how do you interact with the culture in a way to restore it?
Welcome to Rochester Business Connections, powered by Baubert Marketing, LLC, where I get the chance to chat with Rochester, New York's very best business owners, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders. I am your host, Ben Albert. Don't forget to subscribe, and remember, we don't do advertisements. My fee for this show is simple. If you gain value from the episode, personally share with a friend and explain your favorite part. Let's get started. I'm here with Aaron Hanlon. Aaron, how are we doing today?
I'm really good. Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm excited to have you here. We said offline before this, it's been a crazy morning for me. So right now I'm just venting. However, this is literally the most fun part of my day. I'm super excited to have you on. And you have a lot of activities. You have an entrepreneur spirit. You have a lot of different activities locally, businesses you work for that all work together. So I'm interested to see exactly how the conversation goes.
Yeah, me too.
Rather than introducing you, I want to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself in whatever way feels most comfortable for you.
Yeah, so I guess I would introduce myself as Aaron Hanlon. I wouldn't say I'm a Rochesterian, as I was born in New England, moved here in 2010, and have a lot of different intersecting interests that come together, both personally from myself as well as my spouse. So I'm really excited to be here on this platform to kind of have an opportunity to talk about kind of what's the central kind of mindset for myself and what kind of propels and motivates and creates a lens in which I understand the world and interact with the world.
I love it. And I love higher level. We'll dive as deep, peel back as many layers as we can. I know you work for Highland Hospital. You work, put on events at MUCCC, the Performing Arts Center. You mentioned you and your spouse have a horse farm. Where should we begin? I think horse farm is something that stands out to me. So let's talk about horses. Tell us about that business.
So to be honest with you, it is not necessarily a passion of mine. I grew up with, my family, and my mom was into horses and into dance. And so I was the youngest of three boys and really, in many ways, was very gender fluid. So I aligned very much with my mother and was like, okay, I'm going to do this horse thing. And I was terrible. I got bucked off. They would step on my feet and I would be in pain and screaming. And so I kind of quickly was like, you know what, if I'm going to pursue dance as another option, that was my out. I was like, well, I can't be injured while I'm dancing. So I pursued the dance piece. And then the horse thing kind of came full circle twice over. So in my young adult life, my mom had started, joined a co-op. So she was working with horses again. And I took some lessons, but never again really took to it. And then I met my husband, Chad Basil, and we met online. Funny story, real quick anecdote, it was when online dating kind of just started.
And what app?
It was Yahoo Personals. Okay. It was old. I don't even think that exists anymore.
I haven't heard of them. Go on. Yeah.
And he kind of like flirted with me or whatever they call it. And I looked, and at the time I was in Vermont, and I was like, no, I'm good. And then he sent me a photo of him on a horse. And I was like, oh, well, this is interesting. And it wasn't because of my interest in the horse. It was more of my interest in somebody who had obviously a talent and a strong passion for something that is not easy to master or to understand. And that started us with the emails, and the phone calls, and then the dating. And then fast forward, you know, we did long distance for about 3 years, and I moved here to Rochester to be with him because he's a native here. He's a true Rochesterian. And he owned a home in the South Wedge and was trying to make horses work, you know, obviously not out of the city, but out of the rural parts or the suburbs on the east side of the city. And, you know, it's really expensive and hard at times. And so he really kind of pulled back from depending on other sources outside of him to make it happen. He said, you know what, Aaron, we're going to buy a little farm and we're just going to start from the beginning. And I was like, yeah. And at that time, of course, I madly in love still, but seeing that light in him, and also my interest in being with animals and really opening myself up in a different way in being with horses. So keep on going, fast forward. We bought a small farm. You know, at that time, we didn't have any income, really. He just started nursing. I was a freelance artist. We were lucky enough to get a private loan because the bank wouldn't support us, wouldn't even look at us. And here we are at Croft Hollow, which is in technically Penfield, but Webster address, Croft Hollow Warm Bloods. And we have I've doubled the size of our barn, refurbished the older part of it, knocked down the original house on the property, rebuilt, built a new house. And along the way have built this breeding business together. And when I say together, he's the brains of it all. He knows about the pedigree and how to look for the stallions and align them with the brood mares that we have to produce high quality sport horses for dressage. And I'm pretty good at mucking a stall and massaging horses. I actually have, I was a massage therapist for a number of years. So that was kind of, and dance was also there too. So there was this psychotherapy, social work is also my background. So I had that with the massage therapy and the dance coming into horses with no interest in getting on a horse. So that was the piece that really I became aware of was here I am around these beautiful, massive, virtuosic beings. I have no interest in getting on top of that animal, right? Which Chad gets on and trains them. And to this day, since I have been in a relationship with Chad, which is 13, 14 years, I have yet to get on a horse because my relationship is on the ground with them. And how it's informed me in the other parts of my life, which again is a dance. I have a dance company, Hanlon Dance and Company. My full-time job as a manager of learning and development at Highland Hospital is how to be with people. And everything from meeting people where they're at. So in the work that I do as a choreographer and as a learning and development professional is really about being socially present with other people. And before I really started engaging with horses in this iteration of my life, I kind of came in strong sometimes. Like I was like that abominable snowman, you know, that loves Bugs Bunny, you know, and he's like, I want to hug you and squeeze you. And meanwhile, the bunny's like dying and can't breathe, is asphyxiating. So the horses have taught me how to like, whoa, back up from my agenda, right? My agenda is really kind of secondary and my needs are a bit secondary. So this is leading into kind of my mindset, which is leadership, how I lead myself and be a model to lead other people, how to heal myself, how to be my own hero. As young Pablo says, that's our greatest power, is recognizing, you know, we can be our own leader, hero, and healer. So in those interactions with the horses, you know, there's the potential for danger, right? So if you're not aware, so you have to be kind of like completely emotionally engaged with what's going on with you and the horse, and understanding that they're a fear-based animal, right? So they're always attuned to danger and looking for a threat response to respond to and to survive. So in any moment that you're interacting with the horse, there is this constant importance to be very much aware of them and how they communicate and what they're telling you. And sometimes they're communicating that they don't want to interact with you, mm-hmm. which can be really hard. And if you think about interacting with people, the reality is people don't always want to interact with each other or with me or another person. And for whatever reason is motivating or driving them at that time. So that's a bit about kind of the horse world in terms of how I've entered into it.
I want to jump in and ask you, because a lot of what you're saying, it's social awareness. You're clearly, you've grown into a person who's very socially in tune, but it's very nuanced. I'm wondering if you could provide a concrete example to kind of paint a picture of a time, whether it's massaging a horse or dealing with them, that could kind of illustrate how maybe they're fear-based, or maybe they are emotional creatures that are very, horses are very socially in tune themselves, right? They can feel your energy. I was told, and I'm not a horse rider, but I've been told that horses really can feel your energy and really adapt based on the authoritarian aspect of the person that's helping them. But I'm not a pro at all. I'm wondering if you have any examples from your experience that can kind of illustrate some of these nuances. Yeah.
So they're very social. And so when there's change, there's a lot of processing that goes on with horses. So an example is we brought in a new broodmare recently. So that's a female horse that is kind of groomed for breeding, for lack of a better word. And so Liliana, so she came into the fold, I don't know, several months ago and actually came pregnant. And we have another broodmare, Calais, who is also pregnant. And then we have Tallulah, who is the doma of the farm. So she is the matriarch and really sets the tone for the environment. She is not a broodmare. She is Chad's competition horse.
We could have a whole podcast just on terminology. I love the titles. The titles. Yeah. Go on, though.
And if you came out to the farm, Ben, which I hope you do at some point,
yes, sir.
you will see it happening. And what did happen is, of course, Chad brought her into the fold of the mares. So they share their own paddock. The boys, who are all at this point, none of them are stallions. They've all been gelded. They had an interesting dynamic. So Tallulah became very protective of the other broodmare, Clay. So her ears would pin back and kind of reject Liliana, kind of like, we're not really ready for this. Not sure about who you are and what's happening. And so now I think we're 2 or 3 months in. So that's kind of day one. Today you'll go out and you will see now them all massaging each other. So they kind of head, and they kind of use their mouth to massage their backs. If you can imagine this.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yet there is still a sensitivity to the dynamic between the original two horses. So at any point in time, if there is a disruption or a sense of unsettledness, they kind of revert again to the pinning of the ear and kind of letting Liliana know, like, go away. But that's progress. Like, that's progress socially in terms of them starting to adapt and integrate into each other. So me, in the midst of this, you know, as a human, I observe it behind a fence, but then I go in to the paddock with them as a herd, to interact with them, to clean them. A lot of times, the udders on female horses, they get dirty, and so you got to clean them. And they enjoy it. They actually love the feeling of being massaged and cleaned in that area. So that's something I will do. But I have to also, as I'm attending to one horse, I'm always kind of aware of the other two horses. And I'm always aware of their ears and their energy. Because the last thing I want is to be surrounded by the three of them and then for someone to feel a threat and then buck, right? Or, you know, just start charging and I'm in the way.
You mentioned their ears.
Yeah.
What do you mean by their ears?
In terms of what they do?
Yeah.
What do they do? Yeah. If you watch a horse, you will, I don't know if you can see my fingers in the camera.
Yeah.
Their ears rarely, unless they're very relaxed and released, the ears kind of stay, they're always kind of moving, kind of maneuvering sound, right? And then depending on, you know, sometimes their ears will go back, but it doesn't mean go away. It might be just an extension back, but sometimes, so it's very subtle. And so it's not just like, oh, anytime they pin their ears back, that means they're in a threat response and get out of their way. There have been times when I'm around them and they pin their ears and I look and I sense and I'm like, oh, they're not really in a threat response. They might be stretching.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So when they stretch their neck, your ears might go back. So that complexity, right? It really relates to, is that a good example? Does that help?
Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
So imagine now, you know, you're with somebody virtually or physically. And I come in with my agenda, right? And my energy without really kind of opening myself up to the energies of the social realm, right? The collective. In my role, as I see it being successful as a leader and supporting the leadership of other leaders, which is really what I do at Highland, is I'm in the service of other people who are servicing other people who are servicing other people. There's this whole layer of work that is to be done is I find that I'm more successful and able to work with people when I come in prepared, right? So as prepared as I can in terms of understanding who I'm going to be meeting with, what we're going to be meeting about, and the ideas that I might have about the problem or solving it. I'm learning how to back away from that. So when I come in, I'm attuning kind of to the human ears, you know, metaphorically, of horse ears, their energy, where they're at, and then allowing the social presencing as kind of a term that I've come into relationship with through my work with Otto Scharmer's ULAB leadership program at MIT. It's a program that I just went through this past semester. And my understanding of that is very similar to being with horses. It's also very similar to how I am with the dancers I work with, gauging where they're at. It's very rare that you have a dance company of people that are fully 100% dedicated to you without any outside interests. Right? No, they have full-time jobs, if not more than full-time jobs. They have families. So how do you gauge where they're at and where they're ready and mentally, physically, conditioned wise? And so my creative process has been impacted by all of this, which also transcends across the lines of my interests. And so what I found is even before I knew what I was internalizing, I was starting to recognize the my creative process choreographically, and which is one in which I have a sense of some kind of vision that's nebulous and not formed, but there's an energy to it. And there might be like two or three words that kind of come to mind. And I'm very transparent. So I share with the dancers this. And then rarely do I ever show movement. I will ask the dancers to solve problems. So it could be something like, come up with a couple behavioral gestures, a utilitarian gesture, use different choreographic concepts to actually start to improvise and to let something emerge that is authentic and true from them. So then you kind of get this source material from the dancers. They've got all this movement that they have cultivated themselves. And you allow, as you're taking what you're seeing visually around you, you as an artistic director, you start to locate movement that all of a sudden starts to connect just naturally to some of my vision, or start to shape the vision in either another direction or in the same direction, but it's starting to shape in a very different way. And that's what's so beautiful about the work, is that when the dance has kind of come to fruition, it's, I don't really desire to replicate it with other dancers, because it's like, well, this is your work. It's really not my work. It's our work. And the same thing with leading a team in more of a business corporate setting, in this case, healthcare, where I have an intimate team and we all have our own personalities, our own behaviors, our own motivators, our own strengths and talents. And so it's very similar to being an artistic director, where I step back to really understand and see what are the talents of the people I'm working with? What are their strengths? What are their affinities? Are they aligned is the work they're doing aligned with those? And in this case, I was very fortunate that I came into a team where there was already an existing person who was strongly aligned, it remains so, and then I was able to hire somebody. And when you're able to hire people, you know, it's a bit easier to, because you're kind of seeing all the kinds of talent of other people and you can do that up front as opposed to kind of coming into an existing team. And sometimes people are mismatched. And they wonder why they're struggling or they're stressed or they're miserable. And, but it's really that a mindset of inspiring, developing talent and the service of an emerging future. That's kind of my tagline. I mean, I can't own all those words. Sure. Emerging future comes from the work with Otto Scharmer as well. But that's exactly what it is. It is the opposite of what we often see in our corporate culture, which is distrust and fear, and the need to have very clear defined data and a very clear defined vision and deadlines. Like all those things like make my stomach just like turn over.
Sure.
You know, because the reality is my acumen has demonstrated that I meet my deadlines and we are incredibly productive and high performing, yet it's built on one of trust. That's kind of the benefit of the doubt by default is I trust you. There's no reason not to trust. And then that allows for people to really be who they want to be or who they are. So that's a kind of a long story short in terms of tying those together. But that intersection is always there.
So they all intersect, and it's taking the talents and the skills and the creative elements of multiple people, bringing them together to create art, to accomplish things that are way better than if you just regimented your tasks. I mean, a lot of people talk about, and I'm going to just ad lib a little bit. A lot of people talk about SMART goals, which are good. You want specific, measurable, actionable goals that you can reach. You watch The Biggest Loser. I don't know the stat, but something like 90% or more of the people that lose weight on The Biggest Loser end up putting the weight back on. So the question I ask is, am I trying to lose weight or am I trying to be healthy? Am I trying to impress someone or am I trying to do something creatively inspiring? Am I measuring myself based on financial excess or am I success or am I measuring myself based on my fulfillment in the moment and my fulfillment with my work and with the assumption that if I feel fulfilled, I'll show up better and things like financial success will come towards me. I'm wondering, because a lot of this is nuance and higher level, where's the balance between the two? I mean, when you're with your dancers, is it 100% improv or are you creating something that you're going to perform in its entirety or are your live performances improvised? I mean, how do you find the balance between being in the moment and doing what's right in terms of bringing everyone's talent into play, but keeping it organized and keeping it measurable so at the end of the day, there's something to show for it?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Is there a way to find the balance?
Completely. And my mother is an artist and my father is an engineer. And I feel like I've adopted both of those.
It's a good combo.
Yeah. And so I am very organized and I plan, but I don't hold to my plans. That's the thing that I've learned. So when I say I don't hold, that's very definitive. Yeah. I've learned not to hold onto the plan. The plan is more for me in terms of a backup, right? it's kind of the feeling of, oh my gosh, if no one's engaged and people are just shut down, at least I can drive my agenda. So I come in with the two or three words that are part of my vision. I come in with very specific problems to align with those, very much like I do in my work in organizational learning development Highland, where I come in and I have maybe a problem that we need to solve from the organization, or there's a need in the organization. And I come up with kind of a preliminary plan, but then I do focus groups. We do surveys, we interview, we get anecdotal information. And my kind of thought and my plan is, again, I don't hold to it. It starts to shift and shape. And again, sometimes it goes in a very different trajectory. Mm-hmm. I use project management in everything I do. So I have my own journaling process for choreographic projects. I use OneNote at work. It's a collaborative platform. It's with Microsoft Office. You can have shared files with people, and it's awesome because it's real timed. Do you use OneNote?
I don't. I don't personally, but it's really great things. I've heard rave reviews.
So you and I could be in OneNote at the same time. And you could be typing in, and I could be typing in. There's no save button. It just updates. It's just organic.
Magic.
Yeah. And so that magic technology is definitely a part of the process. Helps to really kind of hold the history. It's like a, I'm trying to think of the word, folks who are, capture history, or they are watching, they're anthropologists and they're watching cultures and they're documenting behaviors, you know, using technology and other systems to kind of do that for me. Because when you're doing a lot of different things, like that's my brain, are those technologies and those systems. And there's always a core vision and mission, right? On a very micro level to a bigger level of why we're talking about what we're talking about, or why we're doing what we're doing, and how it aligns to, and, you know, in the dance work, it's really about what is the work asking of us? Because sometimes when I'm working with dancers that I don't know very well, they will say to me, well, Aaron, is this what you want? Is this what you want? And this happens at work too, where you'll hear this from team members. Is this what you want? And I'm like, no, it's not what I want. It's what the work is asking of. Mm. So
it's required.
Yeah. And so what that does is it elevates the team or the dance company. They're all artists, right? And they're all accountable to the work. And the same, you know, in organizational learning and development, where we are a collaborative living system. And so I'm kind of coming back to, in terms of how do you balance the, as you were saying, balancing the creative with kind of a sense of plan and action. Is that right?
Yeah, something template that's a template that's goal oriented or planned actionable steps where, you know, you can measure. Yes. One thing I'm bad at is measuring progress, because I understand a lot of things are nuanced and hard to measure. How do you find the balance where you're measuring at the same time as you're creating?
And that's the thing too, is what are measures? How do we define what a measure is? Yeah. So you and I have been talking for about, I don't know, 35 minutes or so.
Not long enough. I'm going to have you back on the show another time because of, well, I don't know if you want to start your own podcast, but you've got a lot of beautiful things to say. You. So I'd encourage you.
Thank you.
But go on.
30 minutes are a measure. That's a measure, right?
Right.
So in, you and I can stop and we can reflect and we can go, What transpired? What were our experiences of the last 35 minutes? Right. And that is that discussion and the depth of that discussion, the quality of that, is that the emerging future. It's what, from the discussion, what has emerged. You know, so as you've only asked me two or three questions, I've been talking a lot, which I tend to do, because there's a lot emerging from that one question. I don't need a lot to emerge.
I like that.
Yeah. And that's what, it can be overwhelming too in the world where there's so much information coming at you. And I have to be like, oh my gosh, like sometimes I stay with a book for a year. Yeah. I'm like, you know, and I know people who have, they read a book a week, you know, and I'm just like, wow, I'm not able to process at the level that I want to.
A new tip that I'm going to start trying that's been recommended to me is to read a book and then read it again.
Oh, so, yeah.
You're not reading a book a week. Preferably you're reading as much as possible. You're learning as much as possible, but somewhere between sitting on a book for 4 months or reading a chapter a day for 12 weeks or 12 day, I don't know, chapter a week for 12 weeks, actually reading the book and rereading it and maybe taking heavy notes the second time. So again, an example of the first time I read a book, I don't know, my mental state affects it. A lot of things affect it, and sometimes I just blur over entire chapters, and then you reread it and you gain more insight sitting with it longer.
Yes, yes. What you're, as you're talking, and again, this is not my language. This is Otto Scharmer's language. What you're talking about is this first go at something where you're either reading or you're hearing somebody speak, and we are still downloading, right? We're downloading the washing machine is still broken, and that's on your mind because you know that's going on for you. You dropped. I was in a forum, and one of the facilitators was working from home and dropped a jar of salsa on the rug, but had to keep going with the meeting. Like, you know, it's sitting there the whole time. You know, you could...
I'd lose it.
I know. She sent me a little chat. She's like, you won't believe what just happened. There's this downloading that naturally happens. And some people call it people's agenda. You know, people are coming in, there's a problem to solve, and they're going to solve it the way they've always solved it. So how, through that first reading of the book, do you allow yourself to just be like, yeah, I'm going to be contending with not being present as much and downloading some stuff that maybe isn't really serving me. And then the second time around, what you're allowing yourself to happen is for the knowledge to emerge from within you in response to what you're reading. And do we allow that in our cultures to be that deliberate in how we understand information and how we interact with each other? And I can tell you that from kind of a top-down hierarchy that, you know, I still work within, I still contend with myself in terms of stepping into that and ego and so forth. There's still this very kind of drive of like, there's a problem, fix it now, and report back to me when it's done. Mm-hmm. You're like, problems are systemic. It's rarely, it may be one person is kind of, we see it in one person at the time, but usually we all of a sudden we see it happening all around. And now leaders have to work across disciplines to communicate with each other, understand what's happening in the culture. And then how do you interact with the culture in a way to restore it? And there is a lot of, I think, fear because people leave jobs. They do. There's just so many opportunities. And I'm kind of speaking in my world. So I don't want to generalize that because I know.
I left a job last year, and it's funny. I just had a career coach on the show, and one thing we joked about is I left a role. I redid my resume. I job searched heavily for a little while, and I didn't get hired. And maybe it was a blessing in disguise that I didn't get hired, that I didn't have her by my side in my ring, allowing me to get hired. One thing she told me is sometimes getting a job or sometimes not getting a job is a blessing in itself. And for me, yeah, I lost my job. I moved on and started my own work because I couldn't find the right fit. But yeah. Personally, very happy and blessed that I had the opportunity and had that moment in my life that shifted me in that direction where I started my own work, because I find that it's empowering and fulfilling every day. And that's what's led to this conversation in itself. So I totally jumped in. I forget what you were saying.
No,
you were talking about
no apologies. That's great, because that is a parallel. Right, it's a parallel to what we're, to the energy of what we're exchanging in terms of sometimes we leave the work, sometimes the work leaves us, sometimes we're asked to leave, sometimes we don't even get a chance, right, to do the work. And what we know, at least, you know, especially in healthcare, it's such a volatile time where we've got this, you know, this pandemic, and now we're coming off of a surge, which we would have had just normally because of the winter. So you've got COVID and a surge in a profession that is way understaffed,
yeah,
under-resourced,
right,
underpaid, and I can say undervalued, which is a needle that changes pretty quickly. So when the surge, I mean, when COVID initially happened, it was healthcare heroes. Healthcare workers are our heroes. And I can say this because my husband's also a nurse and works in healthcare. And so I get the temperature, his perception of the temperature on the front line. And he said, Aaron, it's like a war. It just feels horrible. We're starting to let visitors in, but we couldn't let visitors in. I mean, imagine, you know, your loved one is in a hospital and you cannot be by their side. That healthcare provider is no longer a hero. They are in the way of me and my spouse. And so that needle of value or perception of value changes so rapidly depending on the motives of where the person is coming from. How do you tell somebody that it's in their best interest and it's in their loved one's best interest in terms of contamination and infection?
Right.
But it does not address the emotional need, spiritual need to be with that person. So it is a challenging time for our healthcare professions. And I'm not going to get into how to solve that because it's big. It's probably bigger than I am right now. And I try to maintain a focus of what I can do to make an impact in supporting the work that they do and supporting the leaders that support them. Sorry, my husband's snow blowing.
Oh, I heard that. It's okay. It's okay. It's one thing I love about podcasts is we're diving into the reality. There's snow blowers. We're at home. I've got a cheesy green screen. My dog was barking a moment ago. Don't know if that picked up, but it's all part of the fun.
I've got my dog over here.
I do want to just throw in a thank you to you, your husband, and everyone in the healthcare system. And I like to solve things. I can't even begin to start to try to solve these situations. Haven't really thought about it, but I know personally, my grandfather, my father, they both were in the ICU at Highland when they passed away. And the way that the nurses and the staff treated me, my family, and them is incredible. I might have to cry after this. I'm not going to do it right now, but it was just unbelievable. And now they need to make a leadership responsibility decision that me and the seven members of my family that were there when my grandpa was there, we can't all be in the waiting room. We can't be there every day. And I'm happy I haven't had to be in the hospital in a while now, but yeah, how do you make that decision? What is the right move? This is a podcast in itself. This is something that's unraveling before our eyes. But the only thing I want to say is I'm so happy and grateful that we have strong leaders that actually genuinely care and have that connection to helping each other and helping our community. I mean, what would we do without you guys? So that's just my thought on all that.
I will pass that on.
I wish I had answers. Pass that on. I wish I even had feedback. My only feedback is continue the good work for you, your husband, and everything you guys do.
Yeah. And I will pass that on. And it's great to hear your experience from Highland, because that is what's so wonderful about the culture there. Mm. I've heard people call it a gold mine, right? Wow. Yeah. Because there's something about the energy of where it's situated in the South Wedge, and the folks that work there, that actually drew me. That's what drew me, and the leadership that I met in my interview process. And it's affiliated with the University of Rochester Medical Center. So it's got a very strong relationship, as well as other affiliates, other hospitals. But we do hear a lot of amazing feedback from the community in terms of the care from Highland. We've, as an organization, are, you know, really resilient. But we still have the challenges that every healthcare system has in terms of the volume and the severity and the acuity and the resources. I don't want to put myself out of any other areas of industries, but there's so much reward in working in healthcare. And I've worked outside of healthcare too. And I can say, you know, I haven't done any global research on it, but what's so unique about healthcare is everyone's there because they want to make a difference in someone's life. They want to either help them to care for themselves. They want to heal them, you know, kind of show them these are things that you can do to heal, prepare them and be with them when they're getting ready to die. And I think that's the piece, as you were talking, Ben, that is really coming to fruition with COVID and then these limits of being able to be with people in their times of death, is really understanding what is death and are we as a culture prepared for death? How do we kind of go into that space? And like you said, that's another podcast, another thesis that we could talk about.
Sure.
And I've heard seasoned healthcare professionals say there are worse things than dying. And I'm like, when I first heard that, I was like, what do you mean? And then they talk about the experiences of families not being able to be together, or families being so unprepared for death that it spirals the dynamics in the families out, and people start to fall out of relationships with each other. And so I do invite more and more opportunity in my life to, and it comes through in my artistic work. If you ever have an opportunity to see some of my work or talk to people who have seen it, they'll often say that Aaron explores a darker side, and sometimes death. And it's interesting because when I'm in the work, I'm exploring and celebrating life. So there's that paradox that death and life are pretty intertwined. So with that being said, I close my statement.
The paradox of life. I encourage you, I don't know if you have a blog or you're going to start a podcast, but I encourage you to continue to speak out. I love talking to you. I'm going to have you back on. For sake of time, I want to go to the rapid fire round.
Yeah.
Simple, sweet, easy, either or, fill in the blank. Fun question so we can know Aaron on a personal level. What about favorite ice cream flavor?
Mocha chip.
Mocha chip. Mm. All right. So you're a coffee person, coffee or tea?
I am a tea person. I don't drink any coffee. I don't drink any coffee, but I love coffee, desserts, and ice cream.
I love it. I love it. What about iOS or Android?
iOS.
Favorite book, or name a couple that come to mind.
Well, the one that's on my bedstand and has been there for a year is Inward by Young Pablo. And it's a book of poems and prose. You could close your eyes, open it up, point to something, and there will be something for everyone.
Perfect. Let's get one more. Let's say you were to gift a book to a young reader. What would you gift to that young reader to get them started?
Boy, you know what book I remember is The Giver by Lois Lowry. Mm-hmm.
I haven't read it, but yeah.
Oh, so good. There's a movie, and of course, it's amazing when you read a book and then you watch the movie and you're like, that's not the world that was in my head at all. It's a very powerful book. And it's, I think it's a young adult. It's considered young adult. So The Giver.
The Giver. And Aaron, how do we stay in touch with you? Whether it's a website, social media, email, phone number. We want to learn more. We want to make a friend. We want to support you. What should we do? Where should we go?
LinkedIn is the best. I'm not a, I don't tweet. I don't do Instagram. I have a Facebook.
You don't tweet angry things about our current societal situation five times a day?
No. So LinkedIn, I'm not as impressive or sophisticated with social media, but
sure.
I'm actually engage more with LinkedIn these days, reading a lot of what people are posting. That's how I, through Bob Whipple, you interviewed Bob Whipple.
Bob's great.
Yeah, he is. He's amazing. He's, I really have internalized him and he's become a mentor. He has not agreed to be my mentor. I haven't asked him. I just have really connected with him. And he's got an amazing blog too, which I get posts, just incredible knowledge. So that led me to meet you and see you on LinkedIn and to see your interview with him. And really want to thank you, Ben, for this work. This is the first time I've ever been interviewed in this way. Yeah.
Hey, awesome.
So I was a little nervous, and there was a part of me that wanted to just email you and be like, I can't do it.
I considered canceling because I had the craziest morning ever, and I'm so darn happy that I didn't because it's been incredible. There goes the dog. I hear him.
Yeah, just in time.
Yeah, but it's been a pleasure. Your LinkedIn will be in the show notes. Everybody, I interviewed Bob Whipple, the trust ambassador. Look up that podcast episode. It's great. And I cut us short because we could do a Joe Rogan 5-hour podcast on this stuff. We'll have to do another one. I'm wondering, just kind of in final words, if there's anything that, you know, you prepared to talk about that's come to mind that we haven't had time to chat about, anything to close us with to lead us into part two?
I don't necessarily. I think
it all came naturally. I think I really enjoy talking to you.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I feel pretty full and maybe a bit cliche, but I want to share the intention of waking up to gratitude, which I don't always do. I love mornings, but when I wake up, I'm a bit crabby. So I invite people to shift that. And what I started to do is I put a little post-it on my mirror that said gratitude in the bathroom.
I like that.
And to work towards waking up to do exactly what you love and want to do.
Great way to end it. I love it. But show us gratitude and share this, guys. It makes me feel good about myself when I see the share. But yeah, be grateful. Let's be open and mindful for gratitude. And Aaron, I'm going to have you on the show again because there's a lot of topics that we could still address. I enjoy talking to you again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Rochester Business Connections. Don't forget to share this, rate, and comment on your favorite platform. You can also email me, ben@valbertmarketing.com. Let's connect soon. Until then, keep thriving, everyone.